This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow with some very happy news. We're delighted to be starting today. Our show can be heard on WCQS in Asheville. We are honored to be invited into your lives in Western North Carolina, and we're happy to share with the rest of our listeners the lives and stories of the people who live in this part of the state. One of those people is Don Petty. He's a transplant to North Carolina, grew up just outside of Boston across the river from Logan Airport. Today, he's a fixture in the traditional music scene of Western North Carolina and the Appalachian Mountains. The story of Don's journey to North Carolina includes one life-changing night at a coffee house, a spontaneous cross-country tour, and a passion for the dulcimer. We're going to hear some of that music soon, but first we meet Don Petty, who's joining us from the studios of WCQS in Asheville. Don Petty, welcome to the State of Things. Good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me here. I'm glad to be here.
Well, as we said, anybody who has followed your career and known your work in Asheville probably thinks you've been there for generations, but in fact, you did grow up in Boston. Tell us about growing up in Boston and your first exposure to folk music.
Well, I grew up in Chelsea, Massachusetts, and, you know, kind of a lower working class area. Spent most of my childhood in the housing projects and got out of that kind of situation by going over to Boston. Instead of hanging on street corners, I started hanging at coffee houses during the 60s and got to hear a lot of, well, different music and different ideas. And one of those times I went over to see Judy Collins in the mid-60s, and turned out I was a day late and a dollar short. She was there the night before, and I hate to give my age too much, but it was $3 to see Judy Collins back then.
Don, you are old, but keep going. Keep going.
Exactly. Well, anyway, it ended up that it was Richard and Mimi Farina were playing that night, and Richard played a dulcimer, and for people who don't know, Mimi she's passed away, was Joan Baez's sister. And Richard's music just really, the dulcimer music really spoke to me. And so I got to go up, and there weren't a lot of people there. I went up and spoke with him, and he showed me the dulcimer and about it, and I decided I'm going to get one. And a few years later, it happened.
Well, tell us that story, how you got your first dulcimer.
Well, I had a bunch of friends that by this time I had moved over into Cambridge and, you know, picking up jobs over there and just, you know, I do illustrations and such and just kind of supporting my art endeavors. And a lot of my friends played music and we would all get together a few times a year, you know, about 15 of us. And we were up in Maine at the Agunquit Beach. And everybody's back in town before they run off to school and such. And this one friend came back from the Tassajara Zen Monastery out in California with a dulcimer he had built. And he was a great guitar player. And I said, well, I want to try that. So everybody went off for this walk. And I sat there alone, and they came back, and I was picking out three of the tunes I had heard on that Richard Farina records.
Don, can I tell you how great it is to hear that your first dulcimer came from a guy at a Zen monastery in California to you in Maine? By the way, this is an instrument we associate with the mountains of North Carolina and the rest of the Appalachians, and there you are going all Zen in Maine with this instrument. How cool.
Exactly. And, well, another image that I really like about that time was the Newport Folk Festival, which was that was a big influence on how I saw real traditional players. But sitting in a tent with Doc Boggs, this old man from Virginia, playing his banjo, singing "Oh Death," with a bunch of long-haired types waving back and forth, singing along.
Right.
You know, it's just an interesting image. That goes with that, the whole Zen thing.
Right, and of course that's what was happening, that this mountain instrument had made its way into the coffee houses of Boston and New York. Mimi and Richard Farina, of course, were really important in that celebration for a great day a fine album that was released in 65. But another guy released an album that year called Highway 61 that I think eclipsed the sales for Richard and Mimi. But the instrument itself and mountain music was making its way during that folk revival across the nation, right? This was
sure. And even Gene Ritchie was, you know, getting into the main folk revival scene. And Gene was more traditional, but again, she really did a lot to boost the popularity of the dulcimer. Although Richard Farina took it into another crowd, you know, the contemporary crowd.
So now you're playing this instrument. You've got at least three songs on the beach in Maine. Is this the beginning of your musical career?
It is. That feller, he just said, he was a good guitar player. He said, you just keep that till you get one. And because, you know, my friends were, they were friends. And so I just stuck with that. I ordered one actually from down here in North Carolina. I'd never been here, but I ordered a dulcimer from Ed Presnell, who was one of the few builders that were, well, he sold his at the craft fair here in Asheville.
Hmm. How did you find out? That's interesting because this is back in the your mid-60s, right? So how did you find out about this dulcimer player in North Carolina?
Well, I asked around at the folk scene. There was a big folk scene in Boston at the time, and there probably still is. But, you know, back then, people didn't specialize. They didn't, you know, it was more, if you played folk music, you might play some Southern old time. You might play some British Isles or Canadian. I mean, heck, I used to go down and sing sea shanties on a boat in Boston Harbor, you know, just as part of the thing to do. But people in that scene knew there were certain builders that you would order a dulcimer from. And Ed Presnell was the one that, you know, just struck me as the one to buy from.
So how did
it
you...
It was also... the other ones from around here was the two big ones in North Carolina were Ed Presnell and Edsel Martin, who lived right over here in Old Fort.
Mm-hmm.
And his dad, actually later in the show, I'll play a couple of tunes from his father, who was an incredible fiddle player.
So you get your first dulcimer, not the first dulcimer, but the first one that you ordered from North Carolina. But it was a while before you got here. How did you end up in Asheville?
Well, it was one of these, it was the 60s, you know, and I kind of, you know, and turning into the early, into the 70s. And I was, you know, for a few years, I had this nice life happening where I worked in Aspen, outside of Aspen at Snowmass, cooking at a restaurant up at a ski resort for the winter. And then I was working at a resort in Cape Cod during the summer, and then I was staying back in Cambridge for spring and fall. And on one of these trips, when I was out there in Colorado, these two fellers from Asheville came out there and were playing music up at this other restaurant owned by the same people who owned the one I worked at. And everybody said, you need to go up and see them, fellers. You'd like them. And I went up finally on Thursday. They were there for a week. And I went up on Thursday and said, oh, music I could, people I could play with. So I went up and sat in on a song with them. And from the first song, it was, you know, they said, you need to come home with us.
Wow. Who was it?
This was, there was a fellow named Tad Wright who ended up building dulcimers.
Mm-hmm.
He used to sell them up at the Folk Art Center.
Right.
And Keith Zimmerman, who's a great singer-songwriter type.
Man, I love that. Come home with us. And did you?
Oh, yeah. I ended up, well, they went off and they were on a tour out west and they were doing ski resorts, you know. And so they went out to Utah for a week and said they would come back through and pick me up. And I was going to leave in about 3 weeks, but the fellow that owned the restaurant said, oh, no, you guys are too good. You go on. You know. And so I drove and finished the tour with them and ended up here at Asheville. And frankly, as soon as we come in on Highway 40, we come through Harmon Den and over in Fiennes Creek, something in me just settled. Those mountains just spoke to me, and I literally felt home at home, like for the first time on that earth.
Wow.
I mean, really, yeah, that was home to me.
But it was a bit of a culture shock, like the first time you decided you wanted Chinese food and you weren't in Boston anymore.
That's right. Well, I couldn't just hop on a subway and head over to Chinatown. So I was living out at that fellow Tad Wright's house out in Mills River when I first come, and he said, "All right, well, we'll try to, you know, hook you up with some Chinese food." So just to put it into perspective, Highway 26 wasn't here yet. So to get from Henderson County into Asheville, Brevard Road, which is Highway 280, 191, was the main route. Just that, it's the way it is today. Mm-hmm. And to get out to Spruce Pine, they've straightened that road out three times now since then.
Mountains have a mountain just has a way of messing up a straight road, doesn't it? I mean, there's just that problem. Here's what we're going to do, Don. I really want to hear the story about your first adventure with Chinese food in the mountains, and we'll do that. We're going to take a little break, and then we're going to come back, and I'm going to continue my conversation with Don Petty, and we'll talk also about the development of Western North Carolina since Don moved in with his dulcimer several decades ago. You'll hear about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking with Don Petty, who's lived in North Carolina mountains for 40 years, originally from Boston, and was taking us on a long and winding road to get Chinese food in the mountains. Tell us how that story ends.
All right. So anyway, we got on this road. 2.5 hours later, we passed the town of Spruce Pine and went out to this little Chinese restaurant, kind of out to somebody from Boston in the middle of nowhere, and turned off on this dirt driveway. And sure enough, there was this big Chinese restaurant with like the pavilion kind of styling and the lions outside. And walked inside and up the steps, and here's the big fish tanks and the you know, just looked like a big old Chinese restaurant. And here come this little Chinese girl all in a silk dress and just, you know, walks up to the table and looks at us and says, "What y'all having?" and that was, nothing shocked me since then.
Is it that now you are home? And how was the food? Was anything else around it at all? I mean, I'm getting this.
No,
picture.
No. Wow. This was just it's they've finally closed. I don't know when they've closed them, but it went for many years. If it's it hasn't probably been closed a few years now, but. Yeah. We drove by it, and I said, "Oh, are they still open?" And they said, "No." The people I was with, and it's out past the town of Spruce Pine, and it might build up before long, but not yet.
All right. Well, tell us about Asheville when you first got there, because I guess this is interesting to me, and I didn't know this before, but apparently Asheville's still struggling to get out of debt from the Depression, right? Tell us about it.
Well, I mean, I'm no expert on that, but I think that what happened was that a lot of people in Asheville just didn't take any, they just paid their debts off. I mean, they just stuck with paying it. And so in the 70s, I know that downtown was pretty dead. There wasn't a lot happening. I hate to keep coming back to food, but restaurants were hard to come by.
You're painting quite a picture. I mean, because anybody who's been to Asheville recently will certainly will find it hard to imagine a downtown with A, nothing going on, and B, no restaurants, right?
I mean, there were probably three within walking distance of downtown that I can think of.
But that does mean that you get to see a lot of Art Deco buildings that might not have survived otherwise, right?
Absolutely, and that's really great about what's gone on downtown, is a lot of the old buildings are still here, and they're being renovated, and people, you know, are interested to keep up the old buildings and not tear them down and put up a new structure.
I mean, I guess at first it meant they couldn't afford it. Nobody could afford to do the kind of redevelopment that was going on in other towns, right?
Exactly. But, you know, and now I don't think people really care to a lot of the time. So, right. I mean, they kind of pride themselves on being in a historic building to have their restaurant or whatever the business is.
What are some of the biggest changes you've seen in your 40 years in that part of the country?
Boy, well, there's a lot of changes, I have to say. For example, to me, you know, Asheville is one thing, but now Marshall out in Madison County where I live, now there's a big change. I mean, you know, think about, you know, in the 70s, you know, there was, like I say, the restaurants weren't a lot. But now you can get a cappuccino just about any place, you know. You can't walk around without tripping over a place that'll sell you one. And but in Marshall, the big center for people, where people would go and gather and what was going on in Marshall, was the Home Electric for many, many years. And that was a place where it was, you could buy washing machines and, you know, appliances or linoleum rug, or there was an old man, Marvin Faulkner, used to work there. He'd sit out front if it was slow and play his fiddle. And he only knew about 8 tunes, but if you wanted a fiddle, he had them in the back room hanging on the wall. He'd trade you out of one, or a banjo or something. Well, now that's a cappuccino store. Yeah, you got to go to Lowe's. You want to get your, you know, right. something. And it's not local owned anymore. It's, you know, I mean, it is. I mean, the store is, but, you know, the appliance store isn't.
Yeah. And you were teaching Tai Chi at the Grove Arcade, right? And that was a government building when you were there.
Well, I just went in a time or two and taught led a class for people that worked in the government building in the Grove Arcade, which is now thriving with, you know, just a lot of businesses, was a government building. And it was just a stress reduction time for the people that worked there. But I did have a Tai Chi studio here in Asheville in the late 80s. The guy I was studying with left town and left me a student. So I opened a studio. And that worked out well.
Yeah, well, one of the oldest indoor shopping centers is still around too, in one form or another. Isn't that right?
Yeah, actually, that was. You hear different stories about it, but that was one of the first indoor malls. Was the Grove Arcade?
Wow.
And so, yeah, that's it's and it's
so we have Asheville to thank for that. Is that what you're telling us for shopping malls?
I'm afraid so.
what about the music scene in the 70s, right? That's Belshare is just getting going then. Tell us about the scene then.
Well, you know, Asheville had a very vibrant singer-songwriter music scene happening back then. There were some really excellent singer-songwriters. And coming from Boston, I mean, and being around in the 60s folk revival, I mean, I was very tuned into that. But there were people here like, some are still around. Some people like Malcolm Holcomb is still around, but I think he's living out of Nashville now. I don't know. And Ray Sisk and Larry Rhodes. These were some incredible songwriters from this area. And but at the same time, there was the local traditional music scene. There was the bluegrass and the old time, which was kind of the pre-bluegrass. And there were places like Ms. Hyatt's. It was actually Wayne Hyatt's back then. Her husband was living. And then Ms. Hyatt's kind of just went the way of all these places. She got old and they sold the house, and it's a car dealership now or something. And at the time in the 70s, there was Chubb Parms out on Bear Creek Road out in Leicester. And that was just a fine jam session. Everybody from the area who was anybody in old-time music was out there.
And who was coming to these events? Because it wasn't yet quite the destination it's become now for music tourists, for music lovers, right? Was this mostly people from the region?
It was mostly regional people, you know, and a few people coming through that, you know, for a festival or something would find their way out there, you know, like kind of like Shindig on the Green was happening since the 60s. I think 67, I think that started. And that was more touristy. These were more private, you know, things like Chubb Perms or Wayne Hyatt's.
So you started your music program at WCQS right in the mid 80s, right?
Yes, 1985.
Tell us about that. What was the show all about, and why did you decide to get into radio?
Well, I always liked putting songs together, and I mean, I liked you know, the flow of one thing leading into the next, and then kind of not really telling a story, but opening people's, you know, giving you a chance to make your own story by listening to what I'm playing. And I've always done that. And this fellow I knew had a show on CQS, and it was Saturday mornings, and it was 3 hours. It was called Second Wind, and his name was Tom Dron, and he had been doing it for a while. And he was kind of getting tired of having to do 3 hours a day. And so he and I was interested, and so he asked me if I would be interested to come in and split the show with him. So I did, and instantly started. It was a singer-songwriter kind of show, so I instantly started infiltrating 60s singer-songwriters and throwing in you know, some old-time traditional music when I could. I always like to do things like find a modern song that was influenced by an older song and then play those back to back. And so I started getting into that kind of thing. And eventually over the years, I've done a number of shows on the station and ended up with the one I do now, Close to Home, which is I tend to mostly concentrate first hour on basically field recordings or some commercial field recordings, just the old music, trying to, you know, just to keep it alive so people know what it is.
Well, one of the great things about doing a show like that and thinking about this sort of music in a place like Asheville is it's changing so quickly, and it's such a great scene now that this is where it seems to me you really want to do both. You want to allow that scene to change. You want to allow all the growth that comes from it and all the great people coming in with the new ideas and just be able to say, look, this is where it started. Somebody's got to know where it all started and how it sounded, you know, way back, so that we can let this thing go with a kind of a real bass and never lose the essence. What was happening by the 80s? Belle Chair, for instance, let's talk about the evolution of that as an event.
Boy, the first one was really nice. It was a small little, I don't know if it wasn't like 3 or 4 blocks. You know, it wasn't a very big thing. And it was very nice. It was just, you know, it was kind of interesting. Back then in Asheville, we forget about this, but there was a scene around here where there were people that had either moved to the area or people who were more like college-type people that were into the arts more than a lot of the people living out in the county.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a... You know, so they would do things like they would have Cinematique. They would have movies that were art films or foreign films or just something out of the ordinary once a week. And there would be, you know, a concert, a specific concert, and like maybe Bob Dylan came within the area or something, you know, whatever. And there were 500 people in the 80s. They would all be at the same people would be at each one of these mm-hmm. little, and they actually called it the Asheville 500. <You know>? It was kind of interesting. And now it's like everybody would be part of that. The whole city is kind of that way now. But back then, that was the beginning of Asheville turning more artsy and artsy and artsy.
And as that happened, of course, it became, I think, a greater and greater destination for tourists around the state and around the nation, and I suspect the world. And that always has an impact, and I just waxed romantic about these two things being in tension, continuity and change. What effects do you think that's had as Asheville becomes, and that whole region becomes a greater tourist destination?
Well, I mean, like I say, it's great to have your choice of really good restaurants. On the other hand, it's kind of lost a little of its individuality, and you know, it's lost the more of the small town kind of feel. I mean, you know, you come into Asheville on a Saturday night, and there's traffic, you know, and so that's on the downside. But you know, and a lot of people have retired here, and you know, people move in from out of the area, want to change the way that the local things are done. you know. And so I think it's a good mix at this point.
Of course, if you think about it, I mean, Asheville was the primary vacation. I mean, it was the birth of vacations, right? When the Biltmore was built, nobody took vacations except for the very wealthy, and so there you go.
Exactly, this was a place that was there was an upper class in Asheville. I mean, the Rhododendron Festival was, you know, about debutantes. I mean, that's what was going on. Mm-hmm. And the Mountain Dance and Folk Festival, again, and this was back in the 20s, it's the same kind of thing where they had asked Bascom-Lunsford to bring mountain music as part of the Rhododendron Festival. And so it was, again, there was a big blending of the classes. And a lot of the traditional music tended to be more working class music.
Yeah.
And a lot of the, you know, when the Rhododendron Festival was like debutantes on floats and stuff, you know. So it was kind of an interesting mix. And the Rhododendron Festival has long since been gone, but the Mountain Dance and Folk Festival is still going strong.
Well, I guess that's it. You know, what part does some of this play in maintaining a culture that, frankly, otherwise, I mean, I think about places, New Orleans has to struggle with this, right? I mean, one hand, it is always asked to sort of represent itself as people imagine it coming from out of town, and so they have to have this kind of historic gloss. On the other hand, there has to be an authentic music scene down there that in some ways is kept alive by the very fact of these outsiders insisting that you be the preservation jazz band or something, you know?
And it's true. And the only thing I would say about that is a lot of the – and there is a big old-time music scene happening in Asheville, for sure. I mean, it gets bigger and bigger. And all these young people, it's great to see them interested in it. But the music has been changing to reflect the values of the people who are playing it, as opposed to people who grew up in the mountains. And so it's getting a little slicker, a little quicker, a lot of the old, you know, if it's difficult, you know, the subtle nuances are being lost a lot. And so it's interesting, and I'm sure that will, you know, it goes in cycles, and so perhaps that will come back.
But
now it's kind of rock and roll.
In the mainstream, sort of in the more popular places, but also is there an influence just by the fact that people are coming expecting some kind of mountain culture? Does that create a kind of market for preserving the tradition in ways that wouldn't have been sustainable without it? If nobody had ever shown up, we wouldn't even be able to afford to preserve it.
That's true, and it is. Unfortunately, what happens with those situations is people oftentimes get a caricature of the traditional music, in that it's like the classic example, and it's not from around here. I was out in Missouri playing a job at a festival, and here come this bunch of people. Turned out to be a big family, you know, like a homeschooled kind of family with lots of kids and everything. And they were all in Civil War outfits, and they looked like they just came off the battlefield or something. I mean, they were just really, it was a movie set. They were so good. And I asked them, I said, well, what kind of music do y'all play? And they said, oh, we just play nothing but authentic Civil War music. And I said, oh, great. Well, they get up on stage, and the first thing you see is the girl who was playing fiddle was classically trained, and she played a Shokin Farewell, which was the theme for Ken Burns' Civil War movie, and was written for a music camp in the Adirondacks back in the 80s. You know? So you see what I'm saying?
Right.
It's like, it's like it's kind of preserving something.
Right. But again, you could preserve a caricature and nobody knows the difference. Well, we're getting ready to take a break, but I do want to ask you one quick question about your role in this and your effort to sort of maintain them. And I know you're deeply interested in 19th century mountain music. What do you do to try to maintain some sense of integrity in that music?
Well, I try not to change the music the way I learned it, but to make it appealing to modern audiences, I have found talking about it, stories, just being entertaining and then not changing the music, it, people like it just as well as trying to make the music to be a caricature of itself.
Well, we are going to put that to the test, Don. We're going to take a break right now. We're going to come back and talk to you some more and listen to some of the music of Don Petty, longtime resident of Madison County in western North Carolina, an authority on traditional music in the Appalachian Mountains. And our conversation continues on the state of things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour with musician and culture keeper Don Petty. And Don, I know you are known as one of the premier dulcimer players in the mountains. You've won lots and lots of awards, and we're going to hear you play in just a minute. But give us the history of this instrument, the dulcimer.
Well, it's actually, I found this interesting. Somebody told me a few weeks ago that this was a question on Jeopardy about getting into the modern culture. What is the only American folk instrument? And the answer was the dulcimer.
Wow.
And that's the truth. And this was developed in this country. Well, basically, it came out of an instrument called a zither, which is like a zither, but only it was pronounced zither. basically, a box with strings on it. And it was introduced into this country by the Pennsylvania Germans. And as they migrated down the Great Wagon Road, which the easiest way to say it is it's about Route 81, it was actually an Iroquois Indian trail that went from New York all the way to Georgia. And the wagons then followed that trail down to the south and to the west. And at Roanoke, Virginia, somewhere around there, it split off to another branch of that road called the Wilderness Road that went over through the Cumberland Gap. And in that area between Roanoke back up to Cumberland Gap is where the dulcimer developed, as far as people know. I mean, I've read lots and lots on this, and the one thing I know is I wasn't there. So I won't say for sure. And so, but pretty much that is the accepted feeling of where this instrument was developed. And I will describe it briefly, that the old zithers were a rectangular shape for the most part. And they were long and narrower at one end, a little bit wider at the bottom. And you would slide a wooden stick up and down on, usually on the first two strings, and they could have anything, or the first string one, the melody string. They had frets that were made out of broom wire for the most part. It was like little staples that were made that went under just the first or first and second string. And those staples were in the body of the instrument or on a slightly raised fingerboard that was on the one side, closest to the player. And you would slide a stick up and down that, and that's how you made your music. Mm. Now, some of those, I have one at home that has 12 strings on it, and they were just, you know, meant to, they were just for the style of music being played. In this country, what we did was positioned the fingerboard on the center of the box and raised it up higher and reduced the strings to, well, you know, people do what they want. But
yeah, you can noodle for us while you're describing it so we can hear what you're talking about.
Three or four strings is about.
Yeah. And but you're saying that the frets were only on the first two strings. Does that make the rest of them drones then?
That's exactly right. And on the old dulcimer style of playing, you played only traditionally on one string, the melody string. And you know, back in the 70s, well, even in the 60s, people were, you know, during this folk revival post-World War II, the people had started putting guitar frets on here. And so now the frets went all the way across, so people started chording it. But this is all very modern in the scheme of things. You know, the 60s was not that long ago compared to the 1860s. And so the music started changing, you know.
And so what have you got? What have you got right there?
Chords
and
such.
Have you got a traditional instrument?
I do. I have, well, all of mine I tend to play. It's not that the instrument is traditional. It's the way you play it is kind of a, and there are traditional instruments, but it's a, it would take more than an hour show.
But is your fret going all the way? Is your fret going all the way across, or are you just on the first?
Yes, on these instruments that I tend to play when I go out, I do have the frets that go all the way across. When I do a presentation on the dulcimer, I will bring older instruments, and that I have one that I have these instruments on loan to me. I have one from the 1850s, and one from 1870 from one of the commercial builders. Wow. And those only have the frets going under the first string.
Will you play a song for us?
Yeah, I'll play one for you here. Actually, I wanted to play this one. I wanted to make sure I got this in because pride's not one of the big things in my life, but I'm kind of proud of this. I've been teaching the 4-H after-school program at the Bald Creek Elementary over in Yancey County. And that's through the track, the Tow River Arts Council. But anyway, I did a program for the kids, and that was in the fall, just after the end of the year, Or actually, it was in the spring. It was the end of the year, and I was playing for them. And the next year, I went back and had a bunch of students come. So I'm going to teach them how to play the dulcimer. So I'm showing them Mary Had a Little Lamb and Twinkle Little Star. And they all said, well, aren't you going to teach us The Old Black Cat Couldn't Catch a Rat? And that was a song that I just played for them because it was local. I got it from my friend Bruce Green, who is my music partner for 33 years and a great collector of traditional music. He got it from an old man, Wellesley Cresson, who lived in Burnsville, which is 10 minutes from the school. And Wellesley got it from his uncle, who lived... Wellesley died in his 80s, in the 1980s. He got it from his uncle, who lived back in the hills of Yancey County. Right. And
this is the song these kids wanted to hear. Wow.
They remembered it. They not only wanted to hear it, but they sang it for me.
It is in the water.
From that one time. That was what they were after. So they actually revived a song that is all but gone from that part of the world.
If anybody wants to know what culture is all about, that story just explained everything. It's in your genes and in your ears. Will you play the song for us?
There it is. Okay. Here's The Old Black Cat Couldn't Catch a Rat. 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 Tell me, little girl, what you think of that? Old black cat couldn't catch a rat. Old black cat couldn't catch a rat. Old black cat couldn't catch a rat. Tell me, little boy, what you think of that? Jaybird sitting on a hickory limb. He looked at me and I looked at him. Picked up a rock and I hit him on the shin. He said, little boy, don't do that again.
Don Petty live on The State of Things, a song called Old Black Cat Couldn't Catch a Rat. And what do you think it is, Don? I mean, clearly that has the lyrics that just really appeal to school kids. But, when you talked about feeling the mountains was finally home, even though you'd never been there. And I get the sense that there was something in that song, even if that's the first time they heard it, that it sounded like their song. It sounded like something that was part of them. Am I making too much of that, do you think?
Nope. I think you're absolutely right. It, especially I'm teaching, some of the kids are too young to really learn to play, but they're learning to love the music. I'm going from kindergarten through fifth grade. But they all relate to that song. Now, for some reason, it stuck with them. I mean, I didn't push it on them. I was just proud that they accepted it. You know?
Well, the imagery is powerful.
I like a deep song myself.
Hey, will you do another song for us?
Okay. Well, here's one I'll do from over in Madison County. I'm kind of sticking with just pretty local stuff today. And I've got a bass dulcimer. Now, a lot of the old dulcimers, there was a fella out in Kentucky named I.D. Stamper made huge dulcimers. And they were very big, and they had this deep sound. And it just suited me to do certain songs on this sound. You can hear that's pretty different. So here's a song came from, it goes way back. Cecil Sharp collected this one from a little girl, so it puts it way before, that was about 1919. So this is one I heard it from Jack Wallen from over in Madison County.
Wake up, darling Cora. How can you sleep so sound? With them highway robbers a-raging, gonna tear your playhouse down. Gonna dig me a hole in the meadow. Gonna dig me a hole in the ground. Gonna dig me a hole in the meadow, to lay darling Cora down. Wake up, darling Cora. Go bring me my knife and my gun. Lord, I ain't a man for trouble, but I'll die before I run. Me a hole in the meadow. Gonna dig me a hole in the ground. Gonna dig me a hole in the meadow, to lay darling Cora down. My dear old mother, she told me, has truly come to pass. Drinking and gambling, wild women have proven my ruin now at last. Gonna dig me a hole in the meadow. Gonna dig me a hole in the ground. Gonna dig me a hole in the meadow, to lay darling Cora down.
Darling Cora, sung by Don Petty, a well-known dulcimer player in Western North Carolina. And, you know, when I listen to that song, it strikes me that we know the dulcimers goes way back, but those songs go back even farther, those ballads from the mountains. I mean, that's a song that could have preceded even the dulcimers' trip from Pennsylvania, right?
It could have. I mean, I'm not sure. Now, the dulcimer, I would mention that was in the late 1700s.
Oh, okay.
Like they you know, no, like 1790s through, you know, I think the oldest one they've actually found was about 1815. But they've had, you know, people mention of them in writings and stuff.
But those songs came probably over from, and, you know,
A lot of them came over from the British Isles. Although what's interesting about that is, who was it? Alan Jabbour, who had worked for the Library of Congress for many years. He said he's a fiddle player, a fine fiddle player. He said, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people think that all of our music came over from the British Isles. He said, But, you know, those ships went both ways.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the music that was popular over there actually came from over here, and then they blended back and forth. I thought that was interesting.
And it was the first British invasion did go two ways. The inspiration,
right.
of course, as we know, came from here, over there, and then back again. So that was a lot earlier than we thought. You know, I want to ask you about the music today. I know that you're really active in trying to keep the tradition alive. And is it still relevant today? Is it still important to try to keep it alive?
I think so. I think that there's a lot we can learn from the past. And I think that, you know, it's always good to go forward also. But I think that if we don't, you know, truly understand our past and where we've been, we can't really be as effective in going where we're going.
Well, Don, I want to.
Makes any sense.
It made a lot of sense, and it's been a pleasure talking with you. I want to leave you time to play us out. So first, let me thank you so much for being on the program.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate being here, and it's been a pleasure.
Talking to Don Petty, and I want to thank you for listening to The State of Things. If you want to find out more about the program or take a look at any of the listings that we've talked about, and by the way, we've got some photographs of the Rhododendron Festival that Don mentioned. They're going to be on our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Laura Lee, Megan Modafferi, Anita Rao, and Will Michaels. Our intern, Charlie Shelton. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is our news director. And I want to thank engineer Lee Wilcher for helping us out today at WCQS. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio. Once again, Don Petty.
Here's a few tunes from Marcus Martin. Lived from 1881 to 1974.